Hey, this is Chris Stewart from Root Jack. You're listening to That Much Further West, the podcast.
See the dust. Feels like I'm coming home. I come back into the rust. As I round the corner, you can see me smile. One thing that I remember, one more mile and a good night. Like a lot of high. Yeah, I could die.
Back into That Much Further West, the podcast. I'm Eric.
And I'm Mike.
Sorry to our pal, Phil. He's back in Chicago, death of a friend. So sorry you're not here, Phil, and good luck with everything. But here we are, back in the helm. With our good
season
friend,
number three.
Season three, episode one. And we're going to run a new format and kind of be more artist central. And we couldn't be happier to have our first guest in here with that format in mind, Mr. Chris Stewart of Root Jack.
Hey,
welcome.
Thank you.
Hey, buddy. How are you?
Great.
Good. So we were just listening to Chattahoochee. That was back one of the first bands you were here back in Portland, right? Moonshine Hangover.
Yep.
And looks like maybe that – I saw that as in 2003. Is that correct?
Do you think? Yeah, that record probably was.
Yeah.
Yep.
How long was Moonshine Hangover a band?
We did like 6 years, 6 or 7 years. We did three records. And, we did three records I'm proud of. There's a lot of good songs. There's three songwriters in that band, so it was really easy to come up with, with a record.
And it was you, Will Johnson.
Will Johnson and Troy Henning, Yodeling Dean Henning, and Greg Montpleasure on the drums. Just the four of us the whole time.
Awesome.
We had... Paul Brainerd produced two of our records, and he used to sit in with us whenever we could afford him.
All right.
Yeah, but no, it's just the four of us. Yep.
I missed Moonshine Hangover. You guys were done by the time I got to Portland. So
that's all right. Yeah, there's a lot of good songs on those records. I'm proud of it. I listened to them for a long time, and you guys made me sort of look up some of that stuff, and I was like, oh yeah, it's good stuff. That song is actually a lot older than that, though. I wrote that song like in 93 or 94, and I used to play it in a band I had in Minneapolis called Dagwood, and it was the most decidedly I think I have a tape somewhere of me introducing the song live as a Lynyrd Skynyrd cover, because what we were doing was very, I thought we were Green Day. But it turns out that I couldn't get that Southern rock out of my songs, even when I didn't want it in there.
Right.
Yeah. So, but that was the most egregious, the most obvious one. So that's an old song, but we never recorded or anything. So it was fresh to Moonshine Hangover when I came here.
Right. For the record, I eat a Dagwood sandwich a couple of times a week.
I was going to say, great name. Great name for a great sandwich.
Dagwood. That was before the internet, so I've never even looked it up to see if there's other bands called Dagwood or
there's
not.
There's got to be. There's 10 of everybody now, right? We talk about this all the time, how hard it is to coming over that new thing. And now the internet, you got
it. You Google it.
You Google it, and there's like, oh, there's one in Norway. Yep. There's one in Germany.
Yep.
There's two in Canada. We had a funny conversation one time. You started telling me a story about you wanted to call a band Timber.
Yeah.
With an exclamation point.
With an exclamation point.
And my jaw hit the ground because I was in a group that wanted to call ourselves Timber with an exclamation point. Like, I just was like, I seriously had that conversation with somebody else. So
There was a EDM, like a techno dance band in Florida that beat us to it. And I remember. I remember one of the guys in the band was like, we're from Oregon. We get to be Timber.
Right.
You don't get to be Timber if you're from Florida.
You get to be palm tree.
You get to be seashell or something, man. You can have an exclamation point. That's fine.
We're not going
to
call ourselves the Swamps.
But they made it to MySpace before we did. So.
Oh, MySpace.
Good old MySpace. How I miss you. Let's backtrack just a little bit further. So, I don't even know you and I have been friends a long time. I was thinking about you coming in and asking you some questions. I really kind of have this in my mind or wanting to do some history of you. Like, when was the first time you picked up a guitar? What do you remember?
I have four older sisters, and there was guitars. They had guitars. So there was in the closets of their bedrooms, there was guitars. And they were, they had the strings were about 3 inches off of the fretboard, and you couldn't really play them. But I remember trying when I was little, and I got it in my head that I wanted a guitar, but I think my sisters had acoustic guitars, so I wanted an electric guitar. I'll bet that was it. It was because I remember the family saying, well, dude, we got guitars in the house. You can go grab one. I was like, no, that's not what I meant. I got it in my head. I wanted an electric guitar.
Not a sister guitar.
Not a sister guitar, exactly. And so I don't know if I was probably 14 when my dad was pretty smart. He wouldn't go just buy me something because he had a lot of kids before me, and he'd seen them get toys bought for them and then never get looked at or used. And so by the time I came around, he's like, well, I've been fooled enough times, so I'm not buying anybody anything. He would help me find ways to earn money, though. If I wanted to buy something, then he would help me work for it and earn the money for it so that I could buy it myself, but he would not buy anything for it. So he didn't buy me my guitar. He didn't buy me my, bike when I wanted a bike. He didn't buy me, but he gave me opportunities to work so that I could. So I got $100. It took me a year, but I got $100 together and found a Flying V in a pawn shop. And I think I was probably 13 or 14 years old. The summer between my 9th and 10th grade, I think it was, I had to have surgery on my ankle. So while every kid was out playing and having fun and at the pool, I was on the couch in a cast. But that summer was the summer of Live Aid, and I had MTV, and so I just spent the summer with that brand new guitar to me in my hands in front of MTV, and I recorded Live Aid on a VHS so that then I could just keep playing with it and keep playing with it all summer long.
Luckily, we don't have very many millennial listeners. So they
Live Aid. A worldwide concert, a big concert with old people in it, I guess that's what it was. But,
or they might not know what a VHS tape is.
Right, right. Yeah.
Or MTV.
Yeah, well, that version
so
of MTV.
So I pirated a copy of this concert, and then I just watched it on my phone all summer. The updated version.
Basically of how that goes, yeah. So who were you playing along with on that concert?
Oh, just whatever. I didn't have an opinion about. I liked guitar. I liked rock music, but I didn't have an opinion. I didn't have brothers. Now I've learned that sisters hand some things down to their siblings, and brothers hand some things down to their siblings. And I didn't have brothers, and the thing that brothers hand down is rock and roll to their siblings, and the sisters don't do that. They give you other stuff that's valuable, but I didn't get any of that, so I didn't have any opinions, and I didn't know what was that was hip or that wasn't, or I just liked guitar players. And so I liked all of it, and all of it was new to me. I didn't none of it was everything was fresh. Everything I found was fresh. The first one that I really glommed onto was Bryan Adams. I got a Bryan Adams songbook. Then it had the chord charts, or the little chord diagrams, and that's how I learned how to play chords. And then I knew what chords he was playing, and that's how I learned. I would just play along with Bryan Adams' record. That was the very, very first thing, you know, that was sort of my music. I bought the record. I bought the chord book. I picked out this, you know.
Sounds like it's time for a Cuts Like a Knife cover.
Nah. Exactly.
He played that at a Hoot once.
That's probably come out.
You broke right into it. It was awesome.
All those songs are, it's funny. They're still in, like, they're not at the front of my brain, not even close to it, but it's crazy how they'll come out.
We do kind of talk about you as like this musical encyclopedia, especially at Hoot type of gatherings. You're always busting into some stuff.
They're in there. But I can't, if I try to think of one, I won't.
But if you're just in the moment or you're just
they
playing.
They just jump
just
out of my
out.
Head. Yeah. And I'm shocked when I know the third verse. I'm like, who knows the third verse of that?
Nobody.
Nobody.
Probably, the person who wrote it probably doesn't even know
right.
it.
But sometimes, sometimes it happens.
What if you have us been lucky in that? Like, when you've actually played, like, you did a little thing around in the round. Not in the round, but in the Hawthorne Theater Lounge there one time. And you were doing all these killer covers. And everybody was just singing along with you. It was a ton of fun. And one time at the... it was so funny. You were playing with Shepsky. What's that sit-down place over off of 28th?
The Wine Bar.
Yeah.
Corkscrew or...
No. Press Club.
Press Club. Yeah, that off of Clinton and 28th.
And he got into a mode, and he was just playing all the classic rock. And I'll never forget it. You just kind of said, come on, people. It's called classic rock for a reason. It never gets old.
I did.
Like, it's no so
way.
True.
No way I said that.
No. That's why that's our station in town still stays alive, and that's why you still sing along to those songs, and you're not sick of them. I'm not sick of them.
I'm sick of them.
Yeah.
I'm sick of them because I listened to that radio for a lot of years, and I burned myself out on the radio songs. But that doesn't mean that like that songs that they don't play on the radio, they're still fresh.
Yeah, luckily in my new car I got Sirius XM radio, yeah. And they have that like deep cuts station. Yeah. That it's like one of my favorite stations because it's all the songs that you've heard on the album, but unless you listen to the album a lot, you don't hear them a lot, you know, or you didn't hear them a lot. If you listen to like the oldies radio station or the classic rock radio station, all you hear are the same hits over and over and over again. But that deep cuts one, it's like, oh man, I haven't heard that one forever, or since like I bought the record and listened to it, or you
right.
know, or since my dad played it or something like that. So.
It's something I can't figure out which it is. It's either that, because that was the most people don't continue to discover music post high school. The baby boomers had that classic rock in high school. And so if they never discovered another song, they still had that music. Well, that was the largest population of America for a long time, was those baby boomers. So do we have all those classic rock stations because we have all those baby boomers? Or was that a magic time in you know, rock as art? And that's some of the best, you know, music that was made on the planet, and it still is good and it still holds up, and that's why it's on the radio. I don't think we'll know.
Yeah, it could be.
I don't think we'll know.
Could be a combination of both, or it could, yeah.
Do I love it so much because I've heard it or because it's great?
Yeah.
I don't know which it is.
Do I still put on the old classic jazz station because I think it's great, yet it wasn't my era? Yes.
Well, we're different because we love music, so we've never stopped discovering music. We've never stopped.
Right.
We're not like most people.
We actually talked about this once when you played the fair, one of the shows that you played at the state fair. Did you play the state fair one time?
Yeah, or county fairs, yep.
Yeah, yes. And or maybe you were opening up for Molly Hatchet, maybe.
Yeah.
And you were talking about how those fans really loved you guys, but they were kind of like, didn't know how to find you.
They never would
because
have found
they
us.
Never ever
they don't
they never got beyond listening to Molly Hatchet.
We find that all the time. We'll play with these classic rock, these, you know, dinosaur acts, but their crowd doesn't know that there's a band that they would like that plays in their town at bars for $5.
Yeah.
They have no idea because they don't discover new. They don't even know where would you look to do that. So yeah, that's the only way to, you know, get in front of them is to play with somebody that they do know. And they love music, though. They love music.
Yeah. And you've talked about it. He's like, you said it was funny because I was like, how'd you do in the merch world? And you're like, it was great because those fans have all that Molly Hatchet stuff already. Then they discovered us and loved us and bought a ton of shit.
That's right? Happened. We Marshall Tucker, we played with that's the same thing with any of those bands. Yeah, their fans have if they're there, they've got all their records right. in the t-shirt.
All they're buying is the t-shirt for that tour.
If there is one,
then your guys' stuff
and my stuff.
It's a win.
It's the best. But you know, we'll play, you know, with some of those acts in front of hundreds of people and get a really good response, and then, you know, we'll have 10 or less continue to come out, you know, seek us out and come and see us. And so I don't think that's not a business model.
No. Because they're excited to see
you.
It's
a nice surprise.
They're excited to see, but they're going to go back to their way of life, and they're not going to seek out music.
Not everybody goes sees bands. Yeah. Not everybody likes to be in bars. Not everybody likes to be out at midnight. Not, you know.
And they're not going to find new music until it kicks them in the face, and they're going to be like, oh, this is great. And then the next day they're going to turn on the classic radio station, rock station, and listen to whatever's on there.
Yeah.
They buy that CD, right?
Yeah.
Then they're wearing that out for the next week and telling their other Molly Hatchet friends, check this out.
Yeah, and there's some of that. There's definitely some of that. But, you know, the percentage is low.
It's not sustainable.
Right. It's not the route you're taking, but it's been a fun little surprise to find that stuff. Yeah, exactly. Cool.
Should we have Chris play a song for us? Or are we going to a recorded song? We're kind of free flowing here.
Chris, what would you like to do?
Yeah, let's play another one that's recorded.
All right. So we're going to go into Isaac Parker, and this was off of your second album with Moonshine Hangover. It was called Thicket. And,
we made it in the garage of my condo.
Awesome.
This got Merrily Horde on the fiddle.
Merrily. Now, it may already be 1 second in, so here we go.
It's fine.
All right. Enjoy.
Thank you.
That was Moonshine Hangover with the song Isaac Parker. Off their album Thicket. Tell us a little bit about it, Chris.
I know those guys.
Yeah. Is there a story behind Isaac Parker?
Yeah. I went garage sailing one Saturday morning. Or my family did. Somebody did. And I don't remember if it was me or my wife, but they got the Time Life book, Tales of the Old West, the Gunfighters edition, for like a dime at a garage sale. Is there one in this room?
I have the entire series.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Loggers is right behind you, but the rest of them are upstairs.
So the Gunfighters edition, I was just flipping through it, and there was the tale of Isaac Parker, this Alabama judge who was the hanging judge. I think it just said Isaac Parker, hanging judge. And I read, you know, like a page and a half, and it was just the song. I mean, it was just exactly the song. And, well, the first two verses anyway, right out of the book. And then I had a new mandolin, and so I was just trying to learn it. So I started just reading out of the book and singing the song on the mandolin. And then, like happens to me sometimes, I didn't feel like turning the page. Like, I was so entranced with my new mandolin, and this G minor chord that I was playing was so pretty, I thought. I didn't want to stop and turn the page. So I just made up the third verse. So the third verse is not historical. That's all. I totally made that up. But the first bit of it, that's all true. Well, it's as true as those Time Life books are. I don't know how true they are.
They're great, though.
Yeah, I remember when those commercials came out and everything. Time Life books.
Right?
Yeah, right.
Tales of the Old West. They were so expensive.
Yeah.
And now it was a subscription, too. Like, yeah. You get the first one for free.
Right.
But then they send them whether you want it or not for $20 a month or something.
It's like Columbia House. 10 CDs for a dollar.
Just wait a little bit and go to a garage sale. You get it for nothing.
$5 a piece is what I paid.
That's what you paid?
Yeah.
I'm going to say that's a good deal.
That's a hell of a deal still. On the, yeah. I was just last summer,
but have you ever
read them? The Logger book.
Oh, really?
I've actually read it.
Oh, right.
Yeah. The other ones I haven't gone through, but, you know. Because of the history there, I went right through the Logger book. So, and it's fantastic. You're hooked. They hook you in with the stories and the pictures
if
are
you're
phenomenal.
Interested in that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
Anyways.
You know what I appreciate about those books is that they're not like history books are sort of like big sweeping about societies changing and governments changing and books like that are personal stories. They're about one man at a time, and one that's always interesting. No matter what era, that's always something interesting, and you find lots to relate to. But the big history, what do they say? It's written by the winners, right?
Yeah. Right.
So I don't know how much of that is true, but story of one man, that you know.
It's the winner's interpretation of what happened.
That's it. Yeah.
And we...
we're not going to play another track off the other record, but I never really knew how to say that.
The third Moonshine Hangover record is called Resplendor.
Resplendor.
Which is the closest that we could translate shine in Spanish.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
Yeah, because there's a song on the record called Shine. So.
So post them. What were you doing? Post Moonshine Hangover, what were you doing?
That's Ruchek.
Straight into it?
Yep.
Yeah. You had stuff kind of maybe piling up on the back burner?
No. No. I spent a winter, a long, sad, sort of depressed winter. We played a lot. Moonshine Hangover played a lot, and we did for, 6 years or so. And it was most of the friends I had in the Northwest were, tied up within that band. And so then when I left, in the fall or something, and I had no gigs through the winter, my body was really used to, 11 o'clock on Friday night playing. I found myself, it's kind of embarrassing. I found myself going to, like Guitar Center at 8:30 on a Friday night, just because I just had to move gear. Like I wasn't conscious at all. I would just find myself, doing that. Never fail. You'll notice another dude who just doesn't have a gig that night, but he's just got, you'll notice it, man. Just sad, sad dudes without a gig that night. That's the only people in Guitar Center on a Friday.
Cruising around Guitar Center.
Yeah, cruising. Yeah. Well, and a couple times I thought, maybe somebody will want to jam. And then I was like, oh, this is the exact equivalent of like a pickup bar, or like I'm some sort of stalker or something coming to get somebody to jam. So no, it was sad. It was kind of a depressing winter because my body wasn't ready to stop, because I sure like to go out and play, but I didn't have anybody to go and play with. But I took the energy and I would go down these YouTube wormholes, as you do, you know, and I discovered a whole bunch of music. And every time I would discover a song that was just like made my head cock, like I didn't understand exactly what was going on melodically or musically in the song, I would just learn it. I didn't think this, but what happened was at the end of that winter, I had learned a bunch of new songs, new to me, and sort of dissected them. And I found that, oh, what was different about that was this. In the bridge, they change keys, but they use the same chord structure that they use in the, so all these little tricks where you can repeat, the big soaring moments in your melodies or whatever, but it's different, but it's not, you know? Or like little lyrical things. Just when you pick songs apart, you just learn a bunch of stuff. And so the songs that I learned that winter, pieces of that stuff of song construction is definitely on the first Rootjack record. But I had no songs. And the first many songs that we played as Rootjack, I really loved the Caleb Clauder Country Band at the time. Loved them. And so... I was playing old country songs. We were playing old country songs together, and it didn't work at all. And I was just trying to force it, you know. So we played our first couple of gigs that way.
Did you know Kevin and Chris?
Yeah, I was playing with Chris right away, and then, you know, just a few months later, we had Kevin joined. And so, yeah, it was the three of us were playing together, and we're playing, you know, country songs, and it didn't work at all.
I can't imagine that.
It didn't work at all. Yeah. We have versions of, like, Willie Pete. That's not the version that I wrote. That was a song that would, I mean, it was this completely different feel. Same lyric, really similar melody, but completely different feel. And it was a country thing. And it didn't work such to the point that after playing it a couple times, we shelved it and came back like a year later. And it is what it is with the riff, you know.
Well, let's do something.
That's not the other way. There's more songs like that that they were terrible, and we put them away. And then we just got, after we sort of figured out what our sound was, what we could do, what we were good at, then those were really fun to pull back out and make into, you know, songs that we like now.
Do you remember how originally?
I don't.
Could you?
No, I've kind of had to put it out of my head, because otherwise I'd be confused, I think. And plus, it's been a long, long time, so I don't remember. But there's a tape somewhere. I mean, there's a tape somewhere. I know I had a completely different feel. Same with the Dead Man's Hand from the second record. Mm-hmm. That was, we played that like on our third gig ever. It was terrible. But it's the same lyrics and a really similar melody, but just the feel and everything was. And I remember that when we were deconstructing or trying to reconstruct that one, the way that it ended up now, the way that we know it now, that was a joke. We're like, oh, what about this? You know, just as a joke, just because we're frustrated at how it wasn't working. And then we all kind of laughed and like, oh, yeah, that's ridiculous. Do it again.
I think it's a pretty good metaphor for life, though, that like sometimes things don't work for you and then you put them on a shelf and then you come back to them years later or, you know, months later. And all of a sudden you figure out how it's going to work for you, you know, just all sorts of different things. But it's kind of cool that you could, you know. I think some people think, oh, they wrote a song and like, you know, there it is, you know.
And it has to be that way. And if I don't like it anymore, then I guess, yeah, I still have to play because I only have whatever. Yeah.
But if you can put it on a shelf or you can rework it or reimagine it in a different way, then it could make it a better song or
a lot better,
or at least a new song.
Yeah. Or a new song. Yeah. No, in the cases of those two, there's more too, but in the case of those two, yeah, they became a lot better. Yeah.
Well, that's good.
I'd like to say this on the air. You guys as a three-piece are so stinking strong and so stinking good. And not everybody can pull that three-piece thing off.
Well, we couldn't either.
Well, you figured it out.
It took a while, but we did, yeah.
Because we all stand in awe when we watch you guys play. I mean, Chris on drums is fantastic. But the difference in a three-piece scenario, too, is if you can have a bass man hold it down, while you can still play a solo, right? Because, I mean, you're a phenomenal guitar player, but Kevin is a fantastic fucking bass player. And he does. He isn't just, he fucking plays, right? And that gives, that leaves that portion sounding full so you can do your thing. And it's so good.
We've done, like, a considerable amount of, like, thinking about that stuff. And usually a trio will, what they'll do is, there's a bass part and he's doing whatever he's doing through the song. But when it gets to the solo and that guitar that's been doing this is going to go into the solo,
it drops out.
So what the bass player will do is go, right? He'll just start riding quarter notes. And that's how he fills. Kevin doesn't do that, though. But he'll stay in a groove. And so if the groove doesn't change, a bunch of tricks, like going to the ride doesn't work with three people in a solo. Because, again, the bottom spot, if you keep that in the hi-hat with the groove going, now the lead guitar is what the vocal was. Now it just sits where the vocal did instead of trying to be. Anyway.
Yeah. No, it's
nerdy
like
stuff.
It.
But it's taken a long time. But I remember the show where the light bulb came on. We were playing with Roger Klein and the Peacemakers from Arizona. Mm-hmm. And I think we were playing Trouble No More. And it was a big room and it was loud. And it was the first time we'd ever heard ourselves, you know, that loud. Yeah. And the difference in the dynamics, like that riff sounded awesome. But everything that I was strumming didn't. But that riff sounded, and I even, like, me and Kevin have referenced it since. Like, we looked at each other. Like, we heard it right away. Like, oh, that's the thing. And so that made a big difference. I don't do this on any song. I don't do it on any song. But that also puts us in a box. That means I can't play any songs that go like that. You know, that's strummy. So we're in a box, too. But thank you for saying that.
It's working for you guys.
The other thing is time. We've been playing for 8 years.
Yeah.
Like, anybody who plays as much as we have for 8 years, if you're not pretty tight, you should stop. You know? So
you heard it here first, folks.
unless you're doing a different thing, I suppose. Yeah.
No, I think that's a general. That's a blankets everybody. If you're not playing tight, stop.
Well, just after a long time. It's just
sure. If you can't.
Anybody does anything for a long time, you get better at it. So.
Yeah. That's generally what's supposed to happen.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, in this little segment, you referenced Willie Pete. Would you like to listen to it?
Yeah, is that on the list?
Yeah, that's the next one, actually. So this is off the Root Jack's first album, In the Pine. It's called Willie Pete. Here you go.
Enjoy.
We'll be right back.
as well.
And we're back. Got us snapping. So I thought of a question as soon as we started that, because you had talked about how you've Root Jack's been together for 8 years and how we were talking about how things got stronger and you put things away and come back. Do you notice now, so that was your first album, which you recorded almost 6 years ago now?
Mm-hmm.
Like, are the songs stronger, different now than the album version? I mean, we just talked about off air about how there's a word that's different in Willie Pete, but like, are you guys playing it pretty true to the album version,
yeah,
or is it?
Yeah, that's another thing that's sort of by design. The it's not a better idea. There's not a more valid way to do it. But I really wanted to be simple and stripped down in this band. I wanted to compose the solos, for instance. I didn't want to, because I'd come off of like 10 years of playing lead guitar in different bands where it was all improvisation, which was really fun, but I was also really sick of hearing myself play the same stuff on every song, because when you improv, if you're not super engaged, you're just going to play the stuff that you're comfortable with, and it's always going to be the same. And I literally for 10 years I've been playing lead guitar, and I was sick of hearing myself play. So I thought, if I compose these solos, for instance, then I'll be out playing outside of my box, because I'm going to play melodies, or I'm going to play riffs, or I'm going to do stuff on purpose for the song instead of just play what I normally play. And so then when we play them live, I compose that. Sometimes in the studio, you play a solo and that's just what came out that day. And then every time I play it afterwards, I'll choose to, do I want to recreate that one, or do I just forget about it and just go? But on the Root Jack songs, for most of them, I'd have to like look at a list. But I think for the most of them, like, I really do the solo that I wrote. That means that no, the songs are pretty much the same.
Okay.
The songs really haven't changed that much. Which means that I have some anxiety about playing in front of the same audience over and over and over again. Because we're not that improv band. We're not a jam band. We don't change. You know, we've got a friend who's a taper, and, you know, he wanted to come and do shows. And I told him, I said, you're going to be disappointed, man. They're all going to be the same. We're not that band that, you know, that changes it up. So that's been sort of the cross to bear on that, like I said, is to so I don't feel like I'm repeating myself all the time, is to try to find new audiences. You know, to play those songs too. And that's not a right or wrong. It's just a choice I made in how to compose this stuff. And I think for the trio, again, like, we're in a little box. Like, we have to really be paying attention to make this thing work and not have the bottom fall out and that, you know, things like that. That's one of those things that helps, is that everybody knows what's going to come and when we're going
to. Everyone has their part, and they know how to play it and when to play it.
Yeah. That makes that a little easier. So, no. I mean, I'd have to look. I'm sure there's little things that have changed. No, for the most part, though, they're like they're on the record. It's kind of disappointing.
No, I mean, the album's great, so it's not like it's not like you put out a crappy album and didn't improve on it.
Like I said, it's a way to do it. It's not the only way I like to see music. I appreciate it when people play it like the record. I also love it when I get my mind blown and the song is totally different. I like them both.
Yeah.
I like country and western.
Type of music you play here. Old kinds. Country.
We got Coors and Coors Light. You did the second record not too long ago in 2014, Oasis Motel.
Yeah.
Little gap in between, though. Did the John Brown project as a little side project.
Yeah, man.
And
the John Brown project is cool. You know, Eric, your grandfather was a poet. Mm-hmm. And a logger, and I had some logging songs in Root Jack, and I had showed you a book where I'd gotten some of the stories and some of the ideas from, and you said, "Oh, my grandpa wrote a book like that. You should look at it." And a couple weeks later, you put a book in my hand, and
then 2 weeks after that, you called me and said, "Get over to my house."
Well, I opened up the book, and they looked like my lyric sheets, like I just without even reading a word, just the way that they were structured on the page. I went, "Oh, they're songs." And I just started flipping through, and in about 2 hours, I had written a record. And I recorded them all the very first time on my phone. And, like, I didn't, like, work the song up and then record it. I hit record, flipped the page, started strumming and playing. They just all just came out. And, in fact, I had to go back and listen to them again to learn them because I didn't remember what I had done or how they – it was sent.
Yeah, yeah. It was really powerful. I mean, I remember you came in to your music space, and you're like, I did it, and it all happened really quickly. It was super magical, and I can't wait for you to hear them. And we just sat there together and listened to them. And I just remember I looked at you, and I was like, so what do we do now? And you're like, we're putting together a band, man.
We got to play them now, man.
Yeah, now we can do the band. And I was so happy because you and I were
getting the band back together, right, man.
It was so great to think about. We were all on the same page. We were just like, well, and you had this great idea. It's like, we're going to record it kind of old-timey in that sound. Well, you know, we were talking about the Loggers and how when they came to the West here, they had, you know, some clothes and what their instrument was. And then we talked about those instruments being...
Yeah, just what they could put on their back.
A
you
fiddle.
Know, fiddle
a
was
banjo,
the first
harmonica.
The first white instrument that came to Oregon was a fiddle.
Yeah, yeah.
So the idea was, you know, if these songs are about logging life in the, you know, 1910s, 1920s, 30s, let's play it like you could have played it in those logging camps out there in the woods. Sweet. So, yeah, just stringed instruments and stand-up bass and... Yeah, it's neat. So we just got a bunch of ringers together,
yeah.
And we didn't even have everybody together for one whole practice.
Nope.
And we put up a single mic on a Sunday morning, and we stood around the mic, and we played, and we made a record.
Barry will tell me, like, Chris would be on the mic, but when he'd step away and someone solo, like Marilee, she'd step closer.
Step a little closer.
You know, just
like
they used to do on the stage.
Bluegrass band,
yeah.
But, like, we're not bluegrass people. Like, yeah. I didn't know how that worked. It was just...
And it came together real easy. Birger Olson, he was doing some slide and some banjo for us, and then Marilee on fiddle
and mandolin. I feel like Birger played.
Sorry,
mandolin
it wasn't
it,
banjo.
Maybe?
It was mandolin and slide
and the resonator.
And then
Marilee Horde on fiddle, and Kevin Cowan from Richeck on the stand-up bass. And you played drums.
And
well,
Nick played
drumish.
Yeah, I played a little suitcase kick and a snare drum with a handkerchief on top and some brushes.
And Nick Foltz sang backups.
And did harmonica.
And did harmonica. And was that all of us?
That was everybody. Yeah. It was that simple. And if any of them took a solo, they just moved up closer. And we did it in a few hours.
Yep.
Like, you had sent the songs out there, buddy. I mean, this is not super challenging stuff
musicians. It's Americana. Yeah,
it,
real simple. Yeah.
We stepped in, had a great day, did it all super fast.
I remember somebody had a gig in the afternoon. Like, it wasn't even a night gig.
Marilee.
It was an afternoon gig. So we had, you know, 2.5 hours or something to make a record.
And it was a ton of fun.
And then the few live versions you've done it, it's the lineup kind of changed, though. Because like, I think I remember
it wasn't a band. We didn't make a band.
Yeah,
we made a record.
I think I remember seeing, you guys did it once, and I think I remember seeing
Rich Landar.
Rich Landar.
Last minute, people couldn't make it. So we just put a note up on the internet. Hey, if you got a bass and you want to play a show... Come, like, so it's been like that, that loose.
Yeah.
Because the songs are that simple.
But
and
it was a last minute. Colin?
Yeah, Matthew Collin.
Matthew Collin.
From
our
Australia.
Friend
yeah.
who was living here in a van. Saw it on the Facebook and said, I'm running down there right now.
Yeah.
And literally did his bass right before we started playing. And then Rich Landar.
Rich Landar plays
accordion. Yep.
Yeah, that happened at the Hawthorne Lounge.
Yeah, Cody from the banjo player from Calamity Cubes.
He was there that day, wasn't he?
No, he played with us.
Yeah, that's right. That's totally right.
That's right.
We've had other sit-in steel players.
Yeah, that was my birthday.
We've had just anybody around because they're that simple. Like anybody can jump in.
Yeah.
So no, it's not a band. It's
a
project, right?
Yeah, it's a project. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. People have rotated.
But yeah, I remember. I remember seeing it a few times, and it was just always kind of a different rotating
different.
Cast of characters.
Sure.
Yeah.
When Rich stepped in, it kind of took a almost like a New Orleans feel. To
well,
it.
That
it got a little
his instrument right it definitely brings it to a certain place.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. when you were
we
when you were
electric.
Talking about, you know, instruments that the Loggers could bring with them and stuff like that. I didn't think accordion right away, but I thought that the
squeeze box.
Sure. Yeah,
sure.
No,
concertina
that
or whatever. Yeah,
for sure. That would definitely be one of those.
Right.
But, you know, but Rich brought the accordion in because obviously he's very talented and gifted at that. So,
yeah.
Well, and by that time I was playing electric guitar. And
yeah.
So that was kind of out the window. It's just for, you know, for the record.
For the record, yeah.
Yeah.
I want to play one though.
Yeah,
can
yeah.
I play one?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
So this is the words by John Brown of Vernonia, Oregon. And music by me and key should we do it in boss? Let's do it in that one. This is our horse barn. So some of these songs were specific to the daytime when you were at work. So the details of logging, falling trees, making lumber. And then some of them are about when you go home and country life, pre-running water and life in the Oregon woods. And so this one's kind of about the weekend. In the northwest part of Oregon, there's a little logging town. Eight miles out, Keysie Road, where the Rock Creek wanders round. Met at 80 acres, timber fields and stone. And he worked the fields with horses, holding reins behind their run. Oh, tending to the horses usually fell within my care. But I really did mind all the time that I spent there. I love to climb up high, up in the loft and play. And fly down through the air and land pile of hay. When a friend came over, we would stay out in the barn. Soft hay for a mattress and a blanket to keep us warm. Clear summer night, you could see the moon and stars. Right through Split Shake Root, where we aired our plans and cares. Seemed so funny, hey, through the roof you could see the sky. And when it poured down rain, we were always safe and dry. Well, I always felt so secure, and of course, free from harm. And I got to spend the night in the hayloft of the barn.
That's my favorite song on the album. Yeah. That's a good one. Love playing that one too, because it's got the crescendos and the pull it backs. Anyways, thank you. That was fun.
Yeah.
Sounded really good, too. I think I got the board pretty dialed in tonight.
Way to go, Substitute Philly.
Can I back up and tell the story just a bit more about, like, us?
Yeah.
So now we have this record, and we're like, well, what are we going to do with this? And Chris and I, I think we're pretty much on the same page. We're talking about, like, boy, I could see this being on, like, Oregon Artbeat, or now we got to go play it out in the little town.
Well, it just felt like history. It didn't feel like bar music. It felt like history.
Yeah. So we weren't thinking, let's go get gigs anywhere and do these things. And I said, well, you know, he's about Vernonia. Let's go out. And I told him about Vernonia Days. I wasn't sure if you're...
No, you said...
Were you aware
of
it?
What you said was, have you ever been to Vernonia?
Yeah.
And I go, is it a real play?
Yeah.
So you said, well, I think you need to go to Vernonia.
Yeah, let's get in the van and go. So... We did one day. It's funny, too.
We drove to Vernonia and went straight to the mayor's office.
Yeah, City Hall. Because, well, there's not a lot out there. We went in there and we wanted to talk to somebody to tell us who we would talk to.
Hey, who wants to know about this? Somebody here wants to know about this. I don't know who, but somebody does.
And I think we ended up, I don't remember, the clerk lady was like, well, I don't really know, and I'm not really sure, and it sounds great. And then, boom. The newspaper editor walks in behind us, and she's like, he's who you want to talk to. That's the guy right there. She saw him and instantly was like, that's him.
Passing out these damn city slickers on to you.
Scott Laird.
Scott Laird. So we turn around and say, hey, we're, you know, here's a couple of long-haired hippie guys going, we got this record, and it's all about Vernonia.
Scary biker-looking dudes.
Yeah. We had
You had the long hair.
The longer the time, we had our vests on. We're like, we got this record. And we told him all about it, and instantly he was kind of like, I get it. I understand what you're doing. He hadn't heard a thing. But the funny part was he was actually helping run an art show that day. And did the musician cancel?
Oh, wow, that was that day. You're right.
The musician they were going to have play out on the patio canceled. And Chris had his guitar in the van. What a shocker. And he said, would you come down here and play those songs? And I was so happy to hear Chris say, well, sure, that would be fun. And so there was this little art thing inside and out on the patio, Chris. And so Scott's now hearing them for the first time live, just watching Chris play them. And he got it instantly. He knew exactly what was going on. So it was funny that we just made this trek. I was trying to show you the town. And then we decided to pop in there and say, who would we talk to? So, and then he hooked us up to play Vernonia Days, which is a really big deal. And a lot of people used to live there. Like, this was a huge logging town at one time. And a lot of people still continued to live there for a long period of time through the 50s and 60s and 70s after it shut down. So people know the history of Vernonia.
1957, the world's third largest timber mill closed in Vernonia, Oregon. And all the jobs, the thousands and thousands of jobs that were derived from the world's third largest timber mill that closed, all went away. So 1958 was a dark year in Vernonia, Oregon, because the economy just crashed and everybody left. And so in the middle of summer, to sort of keep the spirits up, and to give something, some day of joy to the people that still live there, they decided to have the Friendship Jamboree. So since 1958, Vernonia's had a little party in the summer in August, and that's just ever since that mill closed. And so it was pretty crazy connected that we ended up going to play this, you know, this. Memorial parade is kind of what it was, you know. Now, this many years later, nobody that goes to it, they don't think about the economy crash. They don't think about the mill. They don't think about any of that stuff. But, boy, it was in our heads. It was hanging over my head pretty heavy.
Yeah. But not only is it what it is now, is not only what you were talking about, but it's also not only are the town folks coming out for this, but the people who used to live there. Or the people that know
that's true.
All the history.
Kids grew up in Vernonia, and then now they're adults that come back for Friendship Jamboree.
And it packs out. Like, the whole city's just packed.
Big logging contest.
Yeah, they have the chainsaw cutting and the hatchet throwing. But the big, giant parade, everybody's lined up for that. And we were right there in Little Park on the side playing, and I thought, it was a ton of fun staying on the property out there. So, yeah.
And then it turns out... That day that we met Scott Laird from the newspaper, he said, you know, there was another group of long hairs up here making music.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
It was about 40 years before us. And there was no recordings of it, but they did make a songbook, which is really interesting because we ended up making
a,
ended up making a songbook. Kind of similar with pictures and everything like this. And that's called the Timberbound Songbook. And what it was is there was some hippies who had just dropped out, and they were up in the woods outside of Vernonia, and they started writing songs. And these were, you know, sort of Woody Guthrie kind of feeling folk songs, but they were all lefty, weirdo, long hair, dropout songs. Like, they were all, they were not, listen, in Georgia, you don't have a history of that. So everything I find out west, when I find this history of freaks, I'm like, oh, this is my people for generations. So he showed us an original. He happened to have an original copy of this Timberbound song. But
yeah.
And now a guy named Joe Siemens, who grew up there, and his mother was in the Timberbound group. She was one of the original singers of that group. He's playing their music now again. So there's a... there's something out there. There's something in those woods. There's some energy. There's some creative energy out there. I'm really convinced of that. We're not the only ones. I've been to a lot of logging towns in the Oregon Coast range.
Yeah.
Not all of them have inspired music, you know, and this town has, and a lot of it. So there's some energy out there. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. In reference to the song, Kesey Road.
Kesey Road, yep.
The Kesey Farm is at the very end of that thing.
Yeah.
We found it one day.
Yeah.
It was quite a long drive out there, but we finally spotted the mill.
And that's actually
a little tiny mill out there.
That's actually where the Timberbound folks were living.
Right.
They built that mill. And so that's where they and then they came back years later, I think close to 1980, and they did do a recording of those songs, but it was years after, you know, when they were written. And so yeah, they had played out in those woods, and there's recordings of, so we're not the first, you know. Freaks to go out there and make music.
You are freaks, though.
We still go out there.
Yeah.
It's a great town. Just for the record, for those of you who haven't been, go. It's funny. It's kind of become this. So they have that bike trail now from the Banks of Vernonia Trail.
Incredible trail.
Yeah. And now people just, their goal is to get to Vernonia, have lunch, and just walk the strip one time, and then they bike back all the way back into town or wherever they park their car. And so it's getting a little bit of that kind of...
Mm-hmm.
They needed that, something mm-hmm. that would bring the people into town, you know. So, I love it. There, you're right. There's a great energy out there.
There's something there, yeah.
Yeah. So.
And then, you know, Rucheck has gone out, and the Burke in Birkenfield is just 15 miles past there or something like that.
Yeah.
And so we play out there in a 100-year-old general store that had logging dances on Saturday nights. They've had dances on Saturday nights for 100 years in this building. And let me tell you, the inside of it sounds like the inside of a guitar. It's all old wood. It's warm and beautiful, and it just seems right when you're playing. You're playing, and people are dancing on a Saturday. You're like, this is what's supposed to happen here. There's a precedent's been set. So it's cool to, you know, to get in on that. Maybe.
We've talked about this a lot, because especially when you guys were trying to do shows and more shows in town, and how much as just banging your head against the wall to get gigs in Portland, because it's usually the same 20 people that show up, and you know, you're thankful for those people. But when you go out to these smaller towns, it's just like this warm hug and welcome of like, thank you for coming out to our towns to do that, you know. And the Burke you've mentioned, and obviously Wildwood and those towns around.
Yeah, we're spoiled here, area. You know, with all of the music that we have access to, and it's usually free, and it's, you know, four shows a night, and it's, you know, Tuesday night you can see something that'll knock you out.
Yeah.
So yeah, to take your little band 45 minutes outside of town where they don't get that, it's the least we can do. We're happy to do that. Yeah, and plus they show up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And Willamina, Oregon, little logging town as well.
Yep. Timbertown, USA.
Timbertown, excuse me, Timbertown, USA. That's right. And I don't know, we talk about this all the time. We seem to run into, to continue on your story, we seem to run into these people that in that town get it. And Katie's a prime example, you know. She owns the Wildwood Hotel out there, and now obviously runs the Wildwood Festival. It's 4 years running.
Yeah.
And she has this hotel and a little space for the. She has the music and the.
So here's my theory. Yeah. I think there's always been people in a little town who get it, but pre-internet they didn't know where to find it.
Yeah.
But now they can find it. And so then they can give us a call and say, hey, I got a little shack out in the woods. Why don't you come out and play here?
I try to tell a lot of the people, a lot of the bands or just or people I know that are traveling playing music, you know, get your gig in Portland. But if you want to stay around the area, like hit up some of these other small places, because especially if you got a weekend out here, they'd love to have you on a Friday, Saturday night. They're going to treat you well. They're going to pay you. They're going to feed you.
Put you in
probably put you in a room. And, you know, and it's going to be much, and you're going to have a great feeling as opposed to being the opener on a show at Dante's where, you know, it'll probably be pretty cool, but, you know, it's like you're the traveling band, you know. People are probably there to see someone else, unless you're
here's
a bigger.
Here's your pizza.
Yeah.
West Coast touring, I mean, unless you can sell 1,000 tickets in a city like this, it's a long way between metropolitan.
Well, especially after you leave Portland and go south.
Yeah, it's a long ways. And so it's that's one neat thing about little towns on the West Coast is that they get bands way bigger than that same size town on the East Coast would ever get.
Because there's a major city every 2 hours.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They have a major market to stop at. They don't have to stop in
Grants
Pass for gas money.
Yeah. Well, and that's why towns like Arcata, California, like get really big bands going through there because it's like, hey, you know.
We got
to
stop.
Yeah. We got San Francisco to Portland. That's 13 hours either straight or that's 3 gigs along the way or 2 gigs along the way.
Right.
So might as well hit them up. And that's why there's places in those towns that make it because they can get those shows.
And then we noticed that they foster, they build scenes, they build communities, they build audiences in those towns.
Yeah.
And it goes north too, Stanwood, Washington, Bellingham. I mean, yeah, that's a, you know, for all the complaining we do about West Coast touring versus East Coast touring, it's hard to tour out here. It's expensive to tour out here, but we get that. And no, there's not a lot of people listening, you know, but the rooms are small, so they're real crowded and it feels like there's a lot. I mean, there's enough. That appreciation makes up for cash almost every time.
Would you rather play to 50 in a small room or 50 in a big room?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What do we got on the playlist?
Well, we're kind of doing a little chronological here. So I'd like to play Mill Whistle. You want to talk about it for a second there, Chris, or tell us? You always have a...
Yeah, this is just one more of those John Brown poems. And this is about the mill. So the other one, if the other one's about weekends, this is about going to work. The Mill Whistle is about, you know, how they'd, you could hear it throughout the whole town and tell you what time it was, when time to go to work, when it's time to get off. What I thought was impactful about this, the idea of this mill whistle is that when the town heard the whistle, yes, it meant it was time to go to work. But more than that, it meant that men got to go to work, which means they got to get paid, which means that families were going to eat, and it means the baby was going to get shoes, and everything was going to be okay as long as they heard that whistle, and the whistle rang for 30 years in this area until it didn't.
Here it is, Mill Whistle.
Where a certain other mills was they often heard whistle, which went all through the hills. For 30 years this whistle told the time of day at the mills operating, meaning there was work and there was pay. And a double life to warn you, it was a quarter to eight. Now 15 minutes another blast mean you're late. At noon signal lunch hour, quarter one, the whistle blew. It was time to snuff that cigarette and return to your crew. Then of course, the sweetest whistle that was ever blown was the one that 5 p.m. medicine was home. I told the time of day, the silence was profound. Well, I don't know where whistles go when mills have to shut down. But for knowing you lost its heartbeat, we lost a familiar sound. And of course, the sweetest whistle that was ever blown
lost her heartbeat. We lost that familiar sound.
Behold, there's Mary Lee Hoard again.
Yeah.
Whistling.
Yeah, doing that male whistle right at the end.
I have a feeling she's on a lot of albums recorded in this here city of ours.
She's great. We love you, Mary Lee.
Yep. I think she's played down here quite a bit.
Yeah.
One of the
lots of different options.
She's a really good musician. She has Mary Lee Hoard has a certain instinct. Not all fiddle players do. And again, this isn't right or wrong, but it's just like it's what I want to hear almost every time. But more than that, Mary Lee can outdrink any fat dude in any band. She's like, she's not a girl. She's just a badass fiddle player that, you know, is fun to be around. So
yeah,
she definitely knows when to step in, when to pour it on, and when to walk away. Like when she's playing fiddle.
Totally.
Even when like Tom V was down here and Eric's like, hey, Mary Lee, play with Tom V. Like just threw her into it and she just walked right into it, did her stuff, and then like walked away.
Yeah.
We're all like, oh, that's how it's done. Yeah. Thank you very much.
He's a professional, but so easygoing, fun, great stories.
You know, that's the deal, isn't it? I mean, you play in bands. Like, if you can't get along, it doesn't matter what sort of virtuoso. I'm not saying not to take anything away from her playing, but that goes a long ways.
Yeah.
If you can get along with somebody.
Big time. She's a lot of fun. Hey, we were briefly talking about Wildwood and the festival in the segment before this. It's been a fun thing. A lot of us in this community here in Portland have, a few of us in the circle have gotten involved in. It's been a ton of fun. Mike and I, obviously, we've been emceeing the thing, and we're so pleased every time we get said to do it. But I know you and Christina have been super involved. Root Jacks obviously played a couple times, and then, but you kind of, was it your idea to come up with this? Whose idea was it for this Sunday morning all-star, the Sunday morning coming down? It's kind of this neat little treasure just to explain to everybody. Is like, you know, for us, we're kind of getting there Thursday and partying, and there's a bunch of setup on Friday, and then, boom, it's off and running, 3, 5 o'clock on Friday. And it doesn't really kind of stop until Saturday.
3 in the morning,
yeah.
Saturday.
Yeah. But the idea was to kind of have a couple other little acts on Sunday morning. And I got to be honest with you. My first original thought was, are you crazy?
Yeah, you told me. Terrible idea.
People also are going to want to do is drunkenly pack up, you know, hungover, pack up their gear and want to make it home because they're going back to work on Monday. I was wrong. I'm glad I was wrong.
No,
it was a great idea, and it's now kind of a highlight.
No,
of
the first time we did it, there was nothing else going on Sunday, and I don't know if it was like we have the equipment paid for one more day. I'm not sure what the idea was, but like, hey, let's do some Sunday morning program.
Yeah,
and so yeah, Katie asked if I would put something together, and so my thought the first year was, okay, you're camping. You wake up Sunday morning. Like, what's a Sunday morning record? What's Sunday morning music? And so we went through a few things, but really quickly I came to Harvest by Neil Young, the Harvest record. Oh, that's a good wake up Sunday morning record. Oh, wouldn't it be neat if we played Harvest? So me and Kevin and Chris, Reject, augmented ourselves with a steel player and a singer. We brought in Matt Cadnelli, the Don of Division Street, because he's the voice of an angel, and even in the morning, and I don't even at night. But he's really familiar with the material. So anyway, we worked up the record, and then we thought, well, it's not about us. We have all these players and all these singers from this band, from these bands who have been here all weekend. Let's see if we can rope them in to get people to come and sing them. So it was like really rolling the dice, because there's no rehearsal time. Like, the band can rehearse, but we couldn't rehearse with any of these singers because they roll in, play the festival, and roll out. There was no time to rehearse with anybody. So I didn't know how it was going to work. We said, let's did a couple things to keep it as simple as possible for the singers who would, or, you know, whatever other instrumentalists who wouldn't be able to rehearse with us. And we worked pretty hard to make it sound kind of just like the record. So there was no surprises for the singer. So that, so the first year we did it, we had some, it didn't work out exactly as we wanted to. But it worked out a lot neater than I thought it ever would. And so it was a really nice sort of Sunday morning, music to pack your camp by, I suppose.
Yeah, and the food vendor stayed open, so they, you know, people were making breakfast burritos, and you're sitting out there on a bale of hay and listening to the harvest.
Yeah.
And you're just
and
like,
it was 101 degrees.
Yeah, but not yet. We had played early.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't yet. wasn't 100.
No, the first year we started early because I remember going, how do you play a show at 9:30 in the morning?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you drink whiskey at 9. That's how you play a show. I learned. But then she said, hey, would you do it again next year? And so I don't remember after much consternation. I mean, we thought of all sorts of other records to do and, like, reasons why that's a bad idea for me to attempt that. But we decided to go Chuglin. Somebody said Creedence. And I didn't want to do a single record, so I thought it'd just be more fun to pick, you know, a bunch of our favorite songs. And so we did it again the next year. Again, we had singers from bands all over the country. No rehearsal. Couldn't rehearse with them, so we told them we'd work them up just like the record. And some of them they did it just like the record, nailed them. And some of them, like, threw us huge curveballs. And there was, like, you couldn't have imagined what was going to happen. It all came off really well. It was very exciting, tightrope walking for a band to say, how is this not going to fall apart? We're playing this for the first time in front of the intended audience, you know, not playing it for the first time in front of an audience, playing it for the first time.
Period.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's a tightrope, but it keeps it pretty exciting. And so then this, that was the second year. And then, this last year, now that the Sunday has expanded to multiple acts, and so it's really has become a third day of the festival. And this past summer, we did like sort of outlaw country, Willie and Waylon, and that was the funnest because that's a little more in our wheelhouse, and it took a little less work, to be honest, to work it up.
Yeah.
And because we were just so familiar with the material, so it wasn't quite as challenging. And then it was really fun.
A lot of great people came up and sang with that too. So
We built a huge band for that, like they do in Nashville. So we had, you know, steel and keys and harmonica and two guitars and acoustic guitar. We had to built a huge band for that one, and that was so fun. We've done it a few times since then. We took the band back out, and we went down and played the Wildwood Hotel one night just because it was too fun to just do once. And then a couple weeks later, we got to do a little thing here in Portland. And we're not opposed to doing that from here on out.
Right.
If anybody asks, we'll probably come and do that in your basement. We have so much fun doing it. And we're all from different bands, and so we like each other's bands. We're fans of each other's as musicians, and so it's a real thrill to stand up next to each other and have this fun and do that. So that's a fun thing. And then... yeah, we'll do it again this summer, 2016, on Sunday. And I'm not being coy or cagey when I tell you I have no idea what we're going to play. And I have no idea who's going to play with us. We'll get there. We'll get it figured out.
Yeah, but absolutely.
It's fun to do. We're not going to – last year it went real late, and we were in the heat of the day, and it actually got kind of miserable. And so we're going to make sure that doesn't happen. We're going to be done a little earlier. But
yeah. Ton of fun though,
yeah.
At Wildwood. And by the way, just for the record, that Sunday, and I'm sure Katie's probably going to keep it this way, the Sunday's always free.
Yeah,
it's nice. Like, she's like, come on,
free in all ages.
Yeah,
all the locals.
Yeah,
you know, she says she wants to give something to them so that they can see what's going on out there without having to buy a ticket.
Exactly.
And then, but it's also all ages. So, you know, like my teenage son brought a bunch of his buddies down.
Yeah,
on Sunday this year.
Sweet.
Yeah, that's a neat thing. That I tell you what, the festivals are cool. They're really fun to go to. They're really fun to play. And there's a lot of them in America and on the West Coast. And even if you just said just Americana festivals, there's a lot of them. I'm so proud to be associated with the Wildwood Fest.
Definitely.
It's so not profit centric. In fact, most, you know, they're doing it to, you know, refill the food bank and put, you know, arts in the local schools. And it's only local food and local wine and now local cannabis. And I'm so proud to be involved with a place that's just not for profit.
Yeah.
You know? And then they put on it. It's a great festival.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic musicians.
Great lineup every year they've had it. It's been amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and never like a list of my favorite bands when you look at who's going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I always end up falling in love with somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's always been some shockers.
Shockers.
Yeah. Just
yeah.
Totally blown away.
Well, they have Katie's got really good taste.
She's really got it dialed.
Yeah.
She's really got it dialed. Matter of fact, you know, I said 4 years, but technically there was that. I mean, she did it as a little present to herself and some people that whole, as we see the stage, and I know this is, you know, on the podcast, but it was actually a little pallet stage to the left.
Where the sound guy is now, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there used to be a little pallet up there. And she invited, you know, the townsfolk and threw some hay bales down and
Charlie Parr and McDougal
and right on John. Right. And camp in our field and have some fun. And it went over so well. She's like, well, I'm going to do this again, but just amp it up just a smidge. And now it's got some legs. It's really
cool.
Yeah,
that smidges.
Yeah. So it's I'm with you, man. We all know in this room how great it is, and we always encourage people. We're always talking about this thing. Go to this festival. You'll walk away. Even if they don't, I don't care.
My point is that this thing is awesome, and I'm so knocked out that we get to be a part of it. You know, whether somebody goes or not, I don't care.
I got a little funny story. It never fails. You and I are on that stage probably more than anybody besides the sound guy. But we're up there all the time, and I feel like I'm running through the crowd or stopping through the crowd or talking through the crowd to other people and artists and friends all the time. But it never seems to fail on that Sunday morning when it's all done and said and we're all walking out. People walk up to me, and they're just like, thank you. Like, it seems like when they're realizing it's over and they're going to go pack their trailer and go home, it never fails that people stop me and say, thank you for this festival. We can't wait to come back next year, and we're bringing friends. And you guys are great, and just keep doing what, you know. And then I realize I really am part of this whole scenario, right? It's a really big deal.
Because for us and for you, I'm sure it's a really tiring weekend.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work.
It's fun.
You guys do a lot of work leading up to it. We basically spend the whole weekend sprinting back and forth, you know, but it's still a ton of fun. And at the end of it all, you're just kind of like,
and we're not the only ones. Cause I see some volunteers who work even
way harder.
Yeah. We get just a smidge behind them.
And I get to see, you know, because my wife who has gig posters by Christina Stewart does the art for it. And so, they're already working on it.
Yeah.
Like this thing is year round. The amount of work that goes into it. Yeah, it's no joke. But also, like, nobody's scowling.
No.
We're happy to do it.
No, it is. We're all so
happy. Two years ago, I got to call on the phone the winner of the raffle prize. They had left early because they had to drive back to Sacramento.
Okay.
And I just remember getting on the, you know, calling, and this lady, like, answers the phone, like, who the hell, you know, where's this strange number calling me? Like, hey, you won the raffle prize. She's like, oh, like, she was so excited. She's like, that was the best thing ever. We drove 8 hours to get there, and we're coming back next year, and it was so much fun, and blah, blah, blah. I was like,
I made that phone call last year, and it was the same thing.
Yep.
We're already home, and I'm packing, but that was so much fun.
Yep. So, yeah, I got her information. I'm sure they, you know, Katie and Kim sent it off.
Since you're right in front of us, magic moment at Wildwood. The power tripped while you were playing. But not the entire. There was two strips. You had the lighting,
which was very
minimal there, which is great. It's not like
not
this
concert
big powerful
lighting.
Show.
No,
it's this minimal kind of like string lighting and a couple things on the cans
it's
on the
stage.
It's
a quaint little party in a field lighting.
It's so much fun.
Yeah.
Well, that generator or something popped, or somebody tripped on something, but Root Jack was still plugged in and going full bore. And you guys didn't even flinch.
No, we had just started Shallow Grave. We had just started sort of a ballad that we do, and the lights
so
went out.
Good.
And afterwards, a couple of people said, oh, we just thought that, you know, it was mood. You know, oh, the ballad starts and they turn the lights down. No, they're all the lights in the place.
No, it just went dark. It was so funny, but you were still live. And again, today's technology, but it was so great because all of a sudden everybody turned their phones on and pointed them towards you.
Yeah.
And not in that kind of lighter way, but they just kind of, so there was this glow on the stage, and you guys never missed a beat. And I remember standing next to the stage saying, greatest moment ever. This is so fucking cool. And then Don found, he clicked it all back in, and I was like, no! Unplug the lights.
At least until the end of the song. Right?
Yeah, like, maybe it happened
we
that way.
We got a mood thing happening.
No,
man.
Some drunk
tripped
over the cord and disconnected it. And I was like, no. But, man, if you had been there, and if you were there, and you know what I'm talking about, that was pure magic. It was an accidental, so great moment. So,
you guys have been involved in two of those.
Rutek has played twice, yep.
No, I mean two power outages.
Yeah, that's true. Jesus
Christ, the truck stop power outage.
That's right.
Yeah.
Rutek, truck stop doing the CD release
party. CD release party at the big fancy room with the awesome sound.
Ponderosa.
Somebody ran into a power pole and knocked out
the power.
Power
was out.
Drunken guy.
We went to the Kenton Club.
And that show was so much better at the Kenton than it would have been at the Ponderosa.
Oh, yeah,
it was. Yeah. It was. Yeah.
Something was magic there. What are the odds that they didn't have a band that night, Friday night or whatever?
Let's run it down.
I'll run it down.
Yeah,
do it, Mike.
Yeah.
So it was your CD. It was Truck Stop Darling's CD release. You guys were. And yours too. That's right.
No, we put both put them out the same night.
And Tony Fulgham was coming down from Seattle.
Yep. Northwind of Jack
North
Rabbit.
Yeah.
Yep.
We hadn't told him we'd worked out something for him.
So it was pre-show, and somebody somewhere near us had hit a power pole and knocked out the power. Backtracking a little bit, on my way to work that day, which I didn't do often, I stopped into the Kenton Club to have a beer. And
I love that. On your way to work, you stop to have a beer.
Well, he works in a bar, so it just works.
So I walk in, and I saw Michael Sean.
I want the kind of job where I can stop at the bar on my way to work.
Saw Michael Sean, you know, talked for a little bit. And it was the very first time I had ever walked through the door in the daylight. And it was the very first time I had ever noticed the address above the doorway. Didn't think of it at the time, but so... Fast forward, power goes out. We're sitting there trying to figure out what to do. I'm on the phone with PGE, and then finally they're
right,
like,
"How long?
Yeah,
will
at
power
first,
be out?
At first it's like
it
an
was
hour.
Out, like maybe we're gonna miss sound check.
Yeah,
but
first
this
it was,
is, it's
the
hours
first one's
before
like
the show.
40 minutes, and then it was like an hour and a half, and then they're like, "It's not coming back on anytime today." So we're all kind of sitting there, and it's just kind of like, and it just popped in my head. It's like the Kenton Club. So I called Michael Sean, and I was like, "You guys got a band tonight?" He's like, "No, we don't have a band tonight." And I'm like, well, you do now, so you should probably just hold on. Went up, and I remember I talked to you guys, and I was like, we can move this to the Kenton Club. And you guys were like, okay. And then I started yelling. I was like, well, we're moving this show to the Kenton Club. Oh, and someone goes, well, what's the address? And I'm like, 2125 North Kilpatrick. And I'm like, I don't know where the hell that, oh, that's where that came from. And then, like, everyone just got up.
All of a sudden, the entire room were our roadies. Everybody grabbed something, and we said, we're right back here, and everybody walked
that's
out.
Right,
everybody was like, I got a tom, I got a cymbal. Everybody just lined, and I was like, just throw it in because we're going to throw it right back out. And then those same people.
That's right. They loaded in for us at the
we got into the parking lot, which was full. People standing there going, and they start hauling it in for us. And
yeah,
so
we went from a room. What's the capacity of the Ponderosa? Is it 500?
450, 500,
right?
Yeah,
500 there. People capacity room to a 150 maybe.
Asshole
to
elbow, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it was packed too.
And so it would have went from a, oh, there's some people here to watch the bands kind of room to a, oh my God, it's packed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was so much more fun.
It was a lot of fun.
It was a ton of fun.
Oh,
and
Nick
it
came
just,
and did the sound.
Yeah, that's
oh
right. Mick came. Yeah,
it's
Mick
like
came.
Everybody was like, "Oh no, the show's there. All right,
the
we're
sound
going
guy
there.
Came with to do the
I
sound."
I was so knocked out that people are like, "Oh, we'll go there for the show. We just want the
Mick.
Show."
I remember Mick looked at the soundboard and he went, "Basically, it was this thing." Yeah. And he was just like, "Oh, all right,
this is gonna be
same.
Easy."
Made it the best it ever sounded in there.
Yeah, I bet you it was.
It
too.
Was.
Yeah, goddamn. And then Tony and Daisy came down, and we had surprisingly worked up a North Twins song between the two of our bands and kind of a little group together. And that was a ton of fun because, you know, we've
That's
known Tony
on
for a long time. It is on YouTube. Yeah. You can find it. It was we've been a fan of his band for a long time, and you had played with his band back in the day. And so we just kind of on the spot said, get up here, and we started dropping into one of his songs, and he sang it, and, God, it was just – everything about that night was pure magic. And then we all went back to the dark
hotel.
We had rooms.
At the truck stop. That's right.
And then
no
just
power.
To kind of cap the story, everybody crawled into their dark rooms, drunk as fuck. And then 3:34 in the morning. But wherever you had, if you had the lights on or
That's
the music
right.
on or anything of the TV on, it all popped on. So you all of a sudden you just sat up in the middle of your bed going, what the hell's going on?
All the lights, the bathroom fan,
yeah.
the TV,
just
all
came
on.
Best of times.
Forgot about that.
It was a good time.
That was a ton of fun. What a great segue into bar lights.
Yeah. There you go.
There we go. Turn the bar lights on.
Chris, thank you, brother.
Thanks. Yeah. I'm flattered to be here. Thank you, guys.
This
yeah,
is
thank you very much.
This couldn't have been better. And so glad that in our new format, you could be the guy to come in here and talk with us and tell us great stories. And we love it, and we love you, and thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate you
yeah.
guys.
Yeah,
thank you.
So this is off of Oasis Motel. You got a little something about this? What do you want to tell us about this song?
This I say it sometimes when we play it live. This is the honest truth. I was we have a little shack out in my backyard where we play music, and we make records, and we have a little bar set up. And I always say it's my favorite bar in town. The best thing about owning your own bar is that it never closes. The worst thing about owning your own bar
is it never closes.
Is that it never closes. And one night I was walking out of my bar, and it turned out it wasn't night. I just started singing the song. The next day was a hoot.
Yeah.
I played it with Mark Digbig.
Digbig.
Thank you.
Yep.
You just say it fast and then roll.
You got
it. Right? I remember playing it with Mark.
Yeah.
The first time, yeah, I sort of wrote it 12 hours earlier. I didn't really write it. I just sort of was singing it on my way to bed. And then I played it at the Hoot the next day, and here it is. It's called The Bar Lights.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for being a part of the podcast.
Yeah.
Everybody, keep checking our listings for live shows. Go see live music. And Chris Stewart, real pleasure. Thank you, friend.
Enjoy.